Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. May 18th, 2023, the What is the Comstock Act edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David. Hey, John.
And by John Dickerson of CBS Primetime, who's just been musing on some of the bigger questions as we prepared to tape this morning. Hello, John.
Hello, David. Hello, Emily. No two people I would rather muse about life's imponderables with than the two of you.
That's good because you're stuck with us.
Exactly. Can you muse on imponderables?
Well, that's a very good point, isn't it? Because by the very act of musing, you are pondering, and therefore it is no longer imponderable. Yeah. Maybe that's the way you can totally eviscerate all your imponderables, is just merely by musing on them.
Oh, it's ponderable now. Yeah. This week on the Gabfest.
Wait a minute. We are so early into the show, and we're already digging really fresh earth with these revelations.
Unlike Special Prosecutor John Durham, did his report reveal a corrupt, politicized FBI poisoned against Trump, or not much of anything? Then what is the Comstock Act, and will it be the tool, the lever, that leads to a ban on medication abortion nationwide? Emily will reveal all. Then Disney versus DeSantis, who is right, who is wrong? Plus, of course, we will have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, listeners, if you want to come ponder with us on Wednesday, June 28th in Washington, D.C. at 6th and I, Historic Synagogue, we are going to do a live show, first live show of the year. Go to slate.com/GabFestLive to get tickets. We're going to have pre-show cocktails with a few of you. There might still be tickets available for that, but it's going to be at 7:30 p.m. We're going to have a guest. It's going to be incredibly fun. It's a great space, and it'll be awesome chance to talk about what's going on and just spend some time with you. So go to slate.com/GabFestLive for tickets. Special counsel John Durham wrapped up a 4-year investigation of the FBI's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Russia during 2016. Durham's investigation of investigation produced almost nothing in the criminal justice system. Two trials ending in acquittals and one guilty plea by a lawyer who doctored some documents to mislead the FISA court. But Durham claimed in his long concluding report that he found bad FBI behavior, that it pursued an investigation of Trump more aggressively than it should have, that it was softer on the Clinton campaign than on the Trump campaign, and that some investigators were tainted by political bias. John, can you remind us what this investigation was fundamentally about?
So thankless.
It was, fundamentally, Durham was supposed to go catch people who had broken the law in investigating Donald Trump and his connection or not connection to the Russians. He was supposed to throw people in jail, and that was in his mandate. I mean, it was to seek criminal behavior and people who broke the law.
While doing what?
Oh, while investigating Donald Trump and his connection to the Russians. So that was in his original mandate, and that's why the ultimate findings are so weak, because you have two reasons to claim the ultimate findings are weak. He not only fell short of his original mandate, and that was the specific mandate, and then there's, of course, the hype that was put out there by former President Trump and his allies, which was that it was not just going to find criminals, it was going to go all the way to President Obama, and it was going to, you know, be a long list of people who engaged in criminal behavior. So that's one way in which his weak record was weak in terms of actual legal action. But then secondarily, there was an internal Justice Department Inspector General report of the FBI that found a lot of bad behavior. And the FBI took measures to fix that. And so there had already been a lot of this work done. Durham's report goes a little bit farther, and it certainly goes farther in its criticism. But given that a lot of this work had already been done, when you look at the amount of time, the amount of work that was done, I think 480 interviews, 6 million different pieces of documents, you got to wonder whether, you know, it was worth all that.
Well, can I just dispute your use of the term weak? I mean, if you are sent to seek to discover whether there's been criminal activity And you basically don't really discover there's been criminal activity. You bring a couple of charges and they don't stick. There's at least an arguable case. You've kind of done your job. Like, you didn't discover the activity. You didn't, you know, go on some witch hunt where you prosecuted people for crimes that never didn't occur. So I don't like the term weak for that piece of it. Like, just because you're appointed as a special...
But that would be fine if he was admitting that. I mean, his rhetoric is super fiery and the substance is weak. And also, the fieriness of the rhetoric has made the coverage and, you know, Trump seizing on this seem like there is something there that there's not.
Right. So I was making the weakness claim relative to the what was and still is publicly claimed about what was done wrong. And if it was so obvious and people broke the law, then he should have been able to win in court. I also think if you bring three actions and you lose two of them, that's weak.
Not in Major League Baseball. I totally agree.
What?
If you go one for three and you're batting,
I got that. Yeah. The reference. I was just kidding. In fact, that's a 300 average. It's pretty good, but I don't think it. Oh, thanks. I don't think that it holds up here as a good analogy.
Emily, do you think, was the FBI wrong in how they pursued their investigation of Trump's connections to to Russia in 2016?
I mean, there's a couple ways to answer that question. So in this report, one of the key issues is this initial tip that came in from an Australian intelligence officer about George Papadopoulos saying that the Trump folks seemed very receptive to getting dirt from Russia. And the only thing Durham is saying now is that they should have opened a preliminary rather than a full investigation at that point. That's like a really minor distinction. And it's being trumped up by Trump and others as like, oh, the FBI should never have investigated at all. That's not what Durham found. And it's ridiculous based on all the things that unfolded from there. There's another set of problems about how the FBI handled these applications to the FISA court to surveil Carter Page. We already know about that from the Inspector General's report, and the FBI already put in place various reforms to address that. That IG investigation is important, and it shone a light into the FBI. It really showed confirmation bias, in terms of continuing its own investigation, I think, rather than some witch hunt against Trump. So that's where we are. I mean, this report from Durham adds just very little to the total picture. And so that's the problem. It's like being cast as this, you know, great injustice to the Trump campaign by the Trump camp. But that's not what it shows.
And don't we need to remember, John, the Mueller report, which was the investigation substantively about whether the Trump campaign in Russia had any connections. And it's true that there were no criminal prosecutions of Trump that came out of that. But there was an extraordinary amount of sort of like smokiness, receptivity to Russian meddling, welcoming of the opportunity to meddle with Russians. So even if in the end there was no active discovery that Trump reached out to Russians and was like, how can we collude to win the election? There was a lot of very dubious behavior that Mueller revealed.
Right, right. And the Mueller investigation ended up sending Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager, to jail. So there were also about three dozen indictments and seven guilty pleas. I mean, there was nothing there for Mueller to investigate. And also, by the way, on the question of obstruction, which is distinct from a connection between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russians, but whether Trump himself obstructed the investigation into that. My recollection is that Mueller decided not to go prosecute because of his reading of the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel ruling on whether you can do that with a sitting president.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to the substance, don't forget there is this evidence that there was a meeting in the Trump Tower in June of 2016. It's Don Jr., Kushner, Paul Manafort. And to set up the email with someone working with the Russian folks, they offered to provide the Trump campaign with official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary as part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. That's the words in the email. And then Donald Trump writes back, "If it's what you say, I love it."
Donald Trump Jr.
Donald Trump Jr., sorry, yes. I mean, if the Russians couldn't deliver, that's what was missing there, not the receptivity, as you're saying, to such a message. I mean, I felt like reading that again, I felt like I was both reliving just like this American nightmare that I wanted to have passed long ago, and also watching another episode of Succession. Like, this is the same kind of behavior that that television show is about, this kind of feckless, especially because it was the kid, Donald Trump Jr., doing this. I just felt like so careless with American democracy.
There is this distinction that I guess Trump's apologists want to make, which is that, sure, Russia meddled in the election and they meddled to Trump's benefit. That doesn't mean that Trump is himself guilty of anything. And it doesn't mean that the FBI was correct in investigating Trump over it, that the FBI overextended itself when it did that. And when it took at face value, or at least less than skeptical value, the Steele dossier.
It's a whole mixed picture, and it's complicated. I think the point now is that, or one thing I was wondering about, okay, so Durham is appointed, obviously, by Bill Barr, who was Trump's outgoing attorney general, and left in place by Merrick Garland, Biden's attorney general, to do his work unmolested. That was the sort of, like, upstanding choice. And Durham proceeded, and you could argue that to get to the end of this and turn out that it's a nothing burger is, like, good for American democracy. Okay, one more person looked. They didn't really turn up anything new. Good. And yet, there is this coverage that is making it seem as if there is a fire here. And so I feel like I like the idea of the investigation turning into a nothing burger. Like, that's fine. That's, like, one way for special counsels to end. And yet then there's also just this problem of what Americans take from this report, and I worry about that part of it.
How do you think Trump and his allies will weaponize this, and do you suspect it will be effective, or just America not really care that much at this moment about any of this?
I think that David Frum wrote, I think, effectively about this in The Atlantic, and he argued basically the benefit of the Durham report. Again, there's stuff here to be angry and unhappy about with the FBI. It's not that far off from what the Hillary Clinton folks were angry and unhappy about with what they saw as confirmation bias among people in the FBI looking into her emails. So they could all get together and have a big, joyful sharing of notes about how when the FBI or some people within the FBI have something in their sights, they go after it and maybe aren't being totally rigorous with their investigative techniques. But I think what David Frum argues is essentially the benefit of the Durham report is allows you to defend Donald Trump in general and specifically with respect to the behavior of his campaign on these Russia offerings, to defend him without having to actually engage in Trump and Russia. You can basically say, look what Durham found. You know, we were right all along. And you can beat up on the FBI and not have to actually defend Donald Trump. There will always be a need with somebody like Donald Trump who breaks the law or rules, depending on what your point of view is, certainly norms. So often, you need a way to defend him if you're a partisan without actually defending his actions. And the Durham report will always serve that role and certainly does now.
Slate Plus members, you get tons of stuff for being a member. You get no ads on any Slate podcasts. You get bonus episodes on some Slate podcasts. And you get extra segments from us every week. And our Slate Plus segment this week is going to be a conversation with Will Salatan, former Slate colleague of all of ours, who has an astonishing series in The Bulwark about Lindsey Graham and how Lindsey Graham capitulated to Donald Trump and what that tells us about authoritarianism generally. So go to slate.com/gabfestplus to hear that and get all those other luscious benefits. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family. Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's the gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. GabFest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GabFest at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Emily, another week, another remarkable series of events around abortion, North Carolina, South Carolina, the Fifth Circuit. Can you start with the latest twists in the Mifepristone case that's challenging FDA approval of medication abortion drugs? What happened? What is happening in the Fifth Circuit?
There was a pretty remarkable oral argument in front of the Fifth Circuit on Wednesday, in which the Fifth Circuit judges seemed very skeptical of the FDA. And from a just kind of purely legal point of view, it was pretty wild. The judges, who two of whom are Trump appointees, are, first of all, seem receptive to an argument about why the plaintiffs, who are a consortium of anti-abortion doctors' organizations, why they have standing to bring this lawsuit against the FDA, in which they're challenging the original approval of Mifepristone in 2000, and also really what's in their sights, I think, at this point, is the FDA's decision in 2021 to allow for people to receive prescriptions of the medication through the mail. And that was based on the FDA's looking at lots of studies showing that mail order prescriptions of abortion pills are safe and effective. So this group of abortion doctors and organizations is saying they have standing to sue. And here's their theory. Their theory is that the mail order prescriptions are more dangerous, and so the rates of women going to emergency rooms are going to rise. And somewhere, in some place, someone in their membership is going to have to take care of someone who came to the ER because they had a complication from a medication abortion. That's a really thin read for standing. It's like a theoretical harm that hasn't even happened yet based on statistical probability. And there's a Supreme Court case from a few years ago written, I believe, the majority decision by Justice Scalia, that refuses to grant standing in exactly this kind of case to an environmental group, which had, by the way, a much stronger statistical claim to actually being affected. What was kind of amazing at oral argument was that one of the judges, Judge Ho, said, well, of course the rates of complications in ER visits are going to rise, when in fact, there's no evidence of that. The reason that the FDA said that the mail order prescribing was allowed was that actually the rates of safe and effective abortion are the same. So the just kind of willful refusal to look at the actual scientific facts was there from the get-go, and it kind of proceeded from there. I mean, one of the judges for the government said that the district court's order, which would have forced the FDA to revoke its approval of the drug, was unprecedented. And the judge said, stop right there. We just had an FDA challenge in here the other day, as if like any challenge to an FDA action is the same. It was really, honestly, kind of bananas. The one thing I will say about this argument is that no matter what the Fifth Circuit decides, the Supreme Court has already said they are going to stay, in other words, stop the Fifth Circuit's order from going into effect until they have heard this case. And so the chances that Mifepristone is going to suddenly get pulled from the market, or even that mail order prescriptions are going to summarily end, that does not seem like it's on the table. And instead, what will happen is the Fifth Circuit will say whatever it's going to say, and then the Supreme Court will hear the case next year.
What is the Comstock Act, and why is everyone such as you all talking about it so much?
Yeah, the Comstock Act was something I wrote about this week. So the Comstock Act is a law from 1873, which was...
Happy 150th birthday.
Exactly. And Anthony Comstock was a very successful crusader against sexual freedom of all kinds. And he persuaded Congress to say that you could not use the mail or any other common carrier to send or receive anything deemed obscene, lewd, or lascivious. And then they specifically mentioned materials used for abortion and, at the time, birth control. And then Anthony Comstock went on this tear. He was designated as a special agent of the post office. He claims to have arrested, and he really did go around, like, with sting operations to catch people sending pamphlets about sex education and art photos and birth control and abortion. In the years... since the 19th century, Congress has repealed parts of the Comstock Act, particularly the part affecting birth control. And the part about abortion just kind of became a relic because of Roe versus Wade, right? You can't have a federal crime of mailing materials for abortion if there's a constitutional right to abortion. And courts had already really narrowed it. Like, it just sort of went away. But now it's back because there is no more Roe versus Wade. And people who oppose abortion and are litigating this case and others are saying, basically, how can the FDA approve mail order prescriptions of abortion pills if it is a federal crime to mail those abortion pills? That's the argument in this case. And the Comstock Act is coming up in other situations. It's still on the books. And so that's why it's having this attempted resurrection.
I was looking up what had happened in 1873, just to kind of land myself historically. That was also the year that Susan B. Anthony was arrested for voting in the 1872 election. So just to kind of put yourself in this historical place where women weren't allowed to even vote, to pick representatives who might do things that might affect their lives. And now we have it related to an issue, obviously, that women care a great deal about.
But John, I find that a slightly tangential argument.
It's just a historical fact.
Yeah, but it's to make a point, which is, oh, this is so archaic. But we have archaic laws, tons of archaic laws on the books. And it is the job of, well, it's the job of Congress to keep those laws updated. And this is the job of the Supreme Court and the justice system to kind of decide how these laws apply. But it's not enough to say, well, it was 1873, so, like, wow, those silly old people, they didn't even let women vote. That's not to me a sufficient that's an irrelevancy.
Well, it's in addition to being an irrelevancy, it's also not the argument I was making.
Okay.
I think it is relevant to think about how the fact that women couldn't vote and until looking pre-Reconstruction era American law reflected the views of a much smaller and specific and exclusionary, group of voters and people. And I think it is totally fair to take that into account, especially when you're talking about a law that effectively went away for many decades. What?
That's Reconstruction era, not pre-Reconstruction era.
Yeah, I meant... Well, Reconstruction is when this gets fixed. And, there are arguments about the end of Reconstruction, what happens, during Jim Crow that are relevant in this regard as well. But I defend John's bringing up this pertinent fact.
Well, I guess the point is that we have a whole bunch of ostensible textualists on the Supreme Court, and they are going to look at this law, which says you cannot send by mail or common carrier anything that causes abortion. Like, why are they not going to be like, well, that's, Congress should repeal that law.
Well, maybe Congress should repeal that law because we shouldn't have laws around that presumably don't reflect people's views. I mean, abortion is still legal in most states, and the idea that you can't mail a single item used for it is out of sync with all of that law. Also, we'll mention that the tools that you use for surgical abortion are exactly the same ones that you use to manage miscarriage. And that has come up in various municipalities where there have been efforts to invoke the Comstock Act to make abortion illegal in particular cities. This is something that's been happening in Texas and New Mexico and other places. And I was watching a whole bunch of just regular OBGYNs, people who don't provide abortion, say, wait a minute, we can't do our jobs if you can't mail and deliver these materials, right? So, but anyway, in answer to your question about the Comstock Act, it is important to remember that what the Comstock Act actually says is that a federal prosecutor can bring charges for mailing. Not, it has nothing to do with FDA approval. And so really the test of the Comstock Act would be if a presumably conservative Republican president were elected and federal prosecutions began under it. That's the like actual power the law grants.
Did if you look at the pre-Roe America, where abortion was legal in some places, was the Comstock Act used to challenge abortion in the places where abortion was then legal?
What the Comstock Act mostly did before 1960 was give federal prosecutors a way to go after people for mailing stuff. Yeah, a lot of it was birth control. Like there's a big famous trial of Margaret Sanger, who started an abortion. And actually, Margaret Sanger was really birth control, not abortion. In like 1916, she opened a birth control clinic in New York City, and they shut it down and charged her under the Comstock Act. That's what it was mostly used for.
So let's switch gears. So, John, North Carolina approved a 12-week abortion ban over the veto of Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. There's a veto-proof majorities in both North Carolina, or veto overriding majorities in both houses of the North Carolina legislature because a Democrat just switched parties. Do you think that this 12-week ban feels to me like it is politically significantly more palatable and less damaging to Republicans than the 6-week bans that are being pursued in a lot of other more conservative states?
Well, I guess the question is whether it's incrementally more or less palatable than the just general state of politics right now, which is that there are a lot of, we've seen, including in the midterms and in special elections, unhappiness about the disappearance of Roe. So you've got that baseline unhappiness, and does 6 or 8, 12 matter? Because whether it's 6 or 12, it pokes that same political bruise for that constituency that cares about that issue. So I don't know if there's an incremental difference between 6 and 12. I think both are keep the issue alive. And I think that in North Carolina will be an interesting test. It's not purple the way people thought it might be after Obama won it the first time. But it'll be fascinating to see if this has reverberations and becomes a part of the presidential campaign in North Carolina.
Well, there's a difference in access because many more abortions, right, obviously. But I will note that North Carolina also imposed a lot of restrictions. If for medication abortion, they took it down to 10 weeks, you have to have an in-person visit with a doctor 2 or 3 times. They imposed these big requirements on clinics, all this. They have to have the same specifications as an ambulatory surgical center, which is like a way of making it really expensive, and you have to have wide hallways. These are called trap laws. They're a familiar tool of abortion opponents from before Roe was overturned. You have to have an ultrasound. They have to tell you that abortion has risks that are not scientifically proven. You have to sit there and listen. Like, it has other things, bells and whistles on it, this 12-week ban.
Just to ask David's question again, to you, Emily, does the difference between 6 and 12 in the nature of the restriction give cause for or allow for arguments that actually could be more powerful politically than I'm thinking?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day. I was doing some reporting on the Ohio ballot initiative about abortion rights that is up in 2023. And their messaging is about, you know, the risks to women, the loss of freedom to women and people who are pregnant. You know, this idea that you're a familiar one from the pro-choice movement, that you're taking the decisions out of the hands of people and their doctors and you're handing it over to the government, and that there's danger that comes from that, increased risks and suffering, you know, and we're seeing that in terms of doctors being afraid to take care of women who come in with infections or with pregnancies that aren't viable, but in which there's still a fetal heartbeat. So I think all of those questions and stories can still arise, whether it's a 6 or 12 week ban. But it is true that a 12-week ban allows for a lot more abortions than these other restrictions, like up to 90% of abortions take place in the first trimester. I want to see how big an effect those other restrictions I mentioned have, because that seems to me that, you know, especially making people come back for multiple doctor's visits if they're coming from out of state, that seems like it could really affect access.
I mean, I do remember, Emily, when we were talking about God and those days not so long ago when we were talking about the Mississippi law, and you were pointing out that maybe the compromise was something more like Europe, where first some trimester abortion is very open and then it's much more severely restricted. I think what you're saying is, yes, the North Carolina law is first trimester abortion effectively, but it is so restrictive and constraining that it's not actually the same as what Europe offers anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's my question about it. It'll be interesting to see what the numbers show. And that will also, though, reflect the desperation women feel in the surrounding states, right? The numbers could stay up in North Carolina because there's no way to get an abortion in a clinic in all these surrounding places. That will be the out-of-state patients.
I want to close, actually. It's almost a way to bridge to our next topic, which is that I do not think there was this attempt in North Carolina to make an argument that if we impose abortion restrictions in North Carolina, businesses are going to flee. This is going to be an inhospitable place for people to do business. Women are not going to want to come live and work here. Lots of people are going to avoid it. I think that this argument is not going anywhere. That we've seen the abortion restrictions come in Texas, Florida, across the South, and there is no evidence at all that it is causing either migration patterns to change yet or businesses to reconsider where they're locating. You don't have big tech companies in Texas saying we're going to go somewhere else. And I suppose in the long run that might change, but I think this hope that corporate America would be so protective of the rights of its employees, particularly its female employees, that they would take significant action to try to stop these laws or to relocate in the face of these laws is a really misguided hope.
Well, there's this problem for corporate America. Like, it's one thing when you're trying to stop one bill or one place, right? That was pretty effective with the anti-transgender bathroom bills a few years ago. When you start having like a dozen or 13 or 14 or 15 states, like, that is, well, then what? You're supposed to leave like the entire South plus the Mountain West. I think that's harder, obviously.
Ron DeSantis and the Walt Disney Company are engaged in a fascinating slugfest. I'm going to quickly run through it. So last year, when DeSantis pushed his parental rights and education bill, which critics call the Don't Say Gay law, Disney's former and current CEOs both spoke out rather mildly against it. DeSantis, who is either enraged or just an opportunistic person, has since taken every possible chance to label Disney a woke corporation and then systematically sought to remove various privileges that Disney has gotten from Florida over the years, basically the right by Disney to control, police, and regulate all its own operations. So DeSantis then stripped Disney of authority over the board that oversaw Disney's special Reedy Creek Development District. Disney, in turn, did an 11th hour end run while it still controlled that board to strip the board of any power to regulate Disney, so that even though DeSantis then had power to appoint the members of the board, those new board members didn't have any power. DeSantis then had Florida undo Disney's action and start to subject Disney to various other regulations, like hilariously inspecting the monorail at Disney World, which had not been inspected. The state had not inspected for 50 some years. The board and Disney and DeSantis and the government of Florida are now involved in a remarkable and actually totally impenetrable and complicated number of lawsuits, with Disney saying it's being punished for its political speech and DeSantis saying that no company should have all the special privileges that Disney is getting from Florida, and he's just acting in the state's interest and trying to rein the company in.
Disney is no longer going to have self-government. They're not going to have their own government. Disney is going to pay its fair share of taxes, and Disney's going to honor the debt, and that's exactly what this proposed piece of legislation will do. If you remember when we first went down this road last spring, a lot of folks in the media were saying that, oh my gosh, Disney's actually going to pay less taxes and Floridians are going to pay more taxes. They were saying that, And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Well, this puts that to bed. And so those debts will be honored and those will be paid. Now, this is obviously now going to be controlled by the state of Florida, which is no longer self-governing for them. So there's a new sheriff in town, and that's just the way it's going to be.
Before we get to kind of the legal and moral questions around this, John, I'm actually interested in the political questions. Is this helping DeSantis generally, the fight against Disney? Is it a political boon for him?
I don't necessarily know. Certainly the anti-woke business in some quarters is a boon. And it's a boon both on its own terms, but then also it's a proxy for he's a culture warrior of our kind. And so it's a like, you know, he's got the right view on these issues. He's kind of on our team, and that's a gateway thing for him. I think the question is, A, how far does that go? B, is it an inroad with Donald Trump? Is there a way he can take this and use this anti-woke business to find a wedge and beat Donald Trump? I think that's a very open question, because the same voters who care about those issues are the ones that have signed up for Donald Trump and call themselves evangelicals, even though they never go to church. So the point being that on the culture war stuff, people just say, yes, well, of course, Donald Trump's on our team. And if you try to find a little distinction to work a wedge in there, I'm not sure it's going to do you any good. I think you can imagine a way in which Donald Trump, and you saw Senator Rick Scott of Florida suggesting this in The Hill on Thursday, kind of saying, like, I always had a good relationship with Disney. I mean, they employ 75,000 people in the state. It's a big company. Like, sure, you know, you may not want to get, like, bad press releases from Disney about your law, but they are a major employer that has a lot to do in the state. And you could imagine Donald Trump saying, you know, I'm a businessman and I don't like Bob Iger. He jumped off one of my business boards because he didn't like my policy on climate. But come on, they employ 75,000 people. Like he's taken it too far, which is a way for Trump to reassert his businessman credentials and attack DeSantis. And DeSantis can't come back and say, oh, you're not enough of a cultural warrior, because Republican voters are going to like, yes, sure he is. He's fine. So I could imagine, since DeSantis may very well, and looks like he's going to announce his campaign next week, I could imagine this being a downside in his combat with Trump playing the sort of businessman card.
I suspect DeSantis has thought about all this, and he is perseverating on this. I mean, he really is. He is not letting it go. There were plenty of chances he had to kind of not stick it to Disney again, and he is avoiding all those chances. So he must feel there's value in it. To me, Emily, this is a case where both sides are kind of wrong. The special privileges that Disney enjoys are unsettling, and the state shouldn't have granted them. But it is also the case that it is unbelievably dangerous and bad for the state government and the governor to use the power of contracts and legislation regulation to basically punish political speech. And I guess that's worse. That part is worse than the fact that Disney is this getting all this kind of chance to have its own police force, and basically.
Yeah, I feel like the second part is so much worse. It's hard for me to really care about the first part, right? And it's also just unconstitutional. Like, the Supreme Court has said several times that the government can't strip people of benefits they're already receiving because of their political speech. And it doesn't matter whether you have a constitutional right to the benefit you're getting or not. It's just obviously retaliation for speech. And this is obviously really chilling, right? I mean, one of the things that's striking is that DeSantis has been going around boasting that since this happened last year, Disney hasn't been involved in any of those issues. They have not made a peep. And so the idea is like, yeah, I succeeded in silencing my critics by using the power of the government to retaliate against them. Like, no, that isn't legal. We don't want that to be legal. We want people and corporate entities to be able to talk. I mean, if corporations are going to have speech rights, then like this is one area in which the government should not be able to step in and take them away. Seems pretty clear. Whatever they're saying.
I also don't know how this, let's imagine he gets the nomination. He's branded himself so much with the fight against Disney and then some of the other pieces of legislation limiting transgender rights for minorities. He's now being sued by Pan America and Random House for about books that are being banned. becoming too associated with being a culture warrior. You know, obviously candidates have always run to their base and then pivoted to the general, but he is, it's got to be a real big pivot in the general election. And I don't, that's a test of political nimbleness that he doesn't really have. He has a kind of a straight ahead political approach and doesn't really have that other key. So it sets him up for that big challenge ahead if he were to get to the general.
Emily, can we go backwards a second? I can't remember where I stand on corporate free speech, right? I know that a lot of liberals were skeptical of the idea that corporations have the same kind of embodied speech rights as individuals, and certainly didn't like that as it applies to campaign finance. Does one's conclusion about Disney and what DeSantis is proposing to Disney change if you assume actually corporations don't have free speech rights? The corporations are not like individuals with free speech rights.
I mean, sure, that would change the analysis. It's just really far from where American law is.
I know, I'm asking you, but I'm asking you as like from a
should
more
it?
I don't remember, and I don't have the brain power this morning to figure out whether I think corporations should have free speech rights in the way that individuals do. But should they, number one? And if they don't, maybe you might not believe they should. And if you don't believe they should, does that change one's analysis of where we are with DeSantis and Disney?
Well, my quarrel with corporate free speech rights is Citizens United, right? Which equated corporations and campaign finance donations from corporations with people and speech. So it's like there are two moves going on there. That, I think, is really a problem. But yes, corporations do need to have some free speech rights. Otherwise, then the government can stop them from expressing any views. And corporations do express political and social and cultural views all the time. And so it's true that the case law I was talking about comes from people, right? This comes up a lot with government employees. Like, what are they allowed to say before they can get fired? And if it's constitutionally protected speech and they're already hired, you can't just fire them because they're criticizing the government or saying something that the government doesn't like. And that's the First Amendment we want, right? We want the First Amendment not to be censoring speech. So in that kind of context, I think it's important for corporations to also be included. It doesn't mean that Citizens United can't also be a problem.
The congruence of speech and money is the problem there, not the speech part.
Forgetting Donald Trump for the moment, I think what the tension in DeSantis's pitch and particularly for the presidency that I was trying to think through here is, on the one hand, he's presenting himself as the anti-drama, administratively focused governor of a big state. And he's got some good numbers in that context his reelection numbers, people moving into the state. And so his pitch is like, if you didn't want all this drama with Donald Trump and you want somebody who's got their eye on the ball, I'm your fella. But this fight with Disney and some of these other things as well, the fight with Disney in particular, it's just kind of like he's got a business interest in the state. And maybe he doesn't want them complaining, but like they are a huge constituent. And he's basically just blown through all of that to keep going on this fight down this endless road. And that's both a hell of a lot of drama and it's not really keeping the eye on the ball. So is that anything that can be either exploited politically or, more important, when you elect somebody to be president who is basically really successful at winning the attention culture war game, how actually successful are they as an administrator and as a person who gets stuff done? Is the thing that they get done essentially highly recognized political gambits and not actually what he says he's running on, which is administrative focus?
I think there's been this assumption in American politics that ultimately corporations get to call the shots with politicians, that you know, they want new regulation on how many chemicals they can dump, they will get those regulations or get a lot of influence, or they want lower taxes, they will have strong influence. Do you think that we've shifted into a world where corporations are in fact subject to politicians in a lot of fights that they used to be able to either avoid or that they won? Or is DeSantis just a kind of outlier case here?
I think DeSantis is mostly an outlier case. I guess what this does make me think about, though, is like Trump declaring war on the press, right? If you can find an enemy that isn't your political opponent that is hated enough by Americans, like that just has a bit that people just like to.
Like Disney. Everyone hates Disney.
Well, that's the thing is I don't think this is Disney. That's why it's such a weird analogy to make about Disney. But if you find corporations like that, I think, sure, then you go after them and then you get the benefit where the press is actually not your enemy, right? The press is not set up to punch back in the same way because the press is trying to cover you and it's quite uncomfortable and asymmetrical. So if you found the right corporation, I feel like you could do that. But Disney is like such a weird fit.
Disney's got other issues and troubles that are sort of outside of Florida that it's wrestling with, which is why I'm really, when I listened to Bob Iger's book on audiobook, one of the things I kept thinking was, man, he takes on these really complicated long-term issues, challenges. Winning over Steve Jobs was one. The other was dealing with whichever Disney family member was on the board that he had to like, for years sort of work through. And I thought, man, that guy's got incredible long-term kind of seize the long game focus. And so I wonder if that will play out here. I mean, they already maneuvered around the governor by basically granting themselves power before the old board was replaced. I just wonder in that debate whether Iger has a set of patience and skill that that will win, or whether DeSantis somehow because he's just politically has a high pain threshold, whether he will win out. Just that competition between the two of them fascinates me.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. I've never been to the Magic Kingdom. I went to Epcot once, so I don't really know where you would sit to watch the sunset and have a drink. But if you were, John, sitting at the Magic Kingdom and having a drink and chattering to beloved Ann Dickerson, what would you be chattering about?
Two chatters briefly. One is the scans of the Titanic. I'm not a huge Titanic person, but the idea of ships, ghostly sort of ships frozen in time at the bottom of the ocean and things hidden from us from history have always fascinated me. There is now a scan of the entire ship. It's quite something to see in its current form. And it also matters because the current form is deteriorating because the bacteria is eating away at the metal. But these scans are, it's very cool pictures. The other thing is the amazing effort by a Nepali Sherpa who here in the 70th anniversary of Edmund Hillary's ascent of Mount Everest climbed it for the 27th time. But what's even more amusing to me, and that is that Kami Rita Sherpa, who is the one who climbed it for 27 times, had shared the record with another Sherpa, Pasang Dawa Sherpa, who just 3 days before had like reached parity with him and was this amazing feat. You had two people. But then 3 days later, Kami Rita beat him. And 27 times up that extraordinary climb is amazing. So just that feat of human endurance is notable to me.
John Dickerson's chatter takes you from the bottom of the deepest ocean to the top of the world.
That's very good.
That is the breadth of John Dickerson. Emily, what is your chatter?
I read a book recently called Divide Me by Zero. It's a novel by Lara Vapniar, and it's about immigrating from Russia, I think, in a lot of ways. It's like a life story. It has a lot of math in it. The main character's mother is a math teacher. I really loved it. I think it's from a couple of years ago, but it just had a lot of it was a very smart book, I guess, partly because of the math, but also had really deep feelings in it. And it totally engaged and diverted me. So Divide Me by Zero by Lara Vapniar.
My chatter, I'm going to run through them super quick because it's a grab bag chatter. First of all, those of you who listened to our Slate Plus segment last week, just an update. Andrew did not get the job at the Catholic school. So he wasn't faced with a moral dilemma. He ultimately was not offered the job there. That's number one. And he suspects maybe it's because they picked up on his political beliefs and thought he might not be a good cultural fit there. That's number one. Number two, if you're in D.C. on June 3rd, we're going to do a live CityCast D.C. We're doing it at Right Proper, great D.C. brewery. We're doing it at their Brookland location. Mike and Bridget, the hosts, are going to be there. I'll be there on hand. And we're going to talk about brewing in D.C. and manufacturing in D.C. And it's June 3rd. It's a Saturday at 1 p.m. You can email me at davidplotz@gmail.com. I can get you on the RSVP list, or we'll put the link to the RSVP in the show notes. It's free. But my real chatter is reading an amazing book also about the sea, The Wager by David Gran. David Gran, of course, is the author of Lost City of Z and Killers of the Flower Moon and just writes these incredible historical mystery adventures. And this is a book about a 1740 British Navy ship that got shipwrecked off the coast of South America and what happened to its crew. And it's astonishing, beautifully written, fascinating book. I hope that I'll talk to David for Gabfest Reads, but you should definitely check out The Wager by David Gran. Listeners, you also chatter. You email them. That's what you do. You email them to us at gabfest@slate.com, and you have sent us a bunch of good ones. And our listener chatter this week comes from John, not Dickerson, another John.
Hello, it's John from Austin, Texas. It was just announced that the four surviving Trappist monks occupying Engelzell Abbey in Austria are leaving, abandoning the abbey they have occupied since 1925. Most Americans know Trappist monks from Belgian Trappist beers, but there are Trappist monks all over the world, in England and Massachusetts, for instance. The Trappists follow the rule of St. Benedict and show their devotion to God through labor, hence Trappist beers, Trappist cheeses, Trappist spirits, etc. Engelzell was the world's only German-language Trappist monastery. The story of how these particular monks came to Engelzell nearly 100 years ago is fascinating. That the last four are now leaving due to an inability to recruit new monks is an historic landmark. I have a very small role in the story. I helped develop their brewery and have sold their beers in the U.S. since they began brewing around a decade ago. I have visited their gorgeous abbey and, due to a scheduling conflict, was even allowed to sit in silent prayer with the monks. I have not seen this reported in English language media, but Google Translate works wonders. I'll add, briefly, that around 2010 I took my girlfriend to the first live GabFest in New York City. I put my name and her name in the hat to win lunch with the GabFest without mentioning it to her. Her name was drawn, she was very surprised to hear David read her name on the GabFest, and we had a lovely lunch with Emily and Hannah. 13 years or so later, we are happily married with two beautiful kids, and still listeners. Thanks.
That's nice. Wait, it was just with Emily, not with...
Emily and Hannah, I think.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't remember doing a lunch with just Hannah, but maybe I did.
Wow. There we go. That's our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugan. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Ops, and Alicia Montgomery is VP of Audio for Slate. Please tweet chatter to us at Slate GabFest and follow us on Twitter there. And email chatter to us also at gabfest@slate.com. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? Special treat today. Will Salatan, writer at The Bulwark, was our longtime colleague and friend at Slate. And Will has spent what must have been months marinating in Lindsey Graham. And he's written a multi-part series, The Corruption of Lindsey Graham, A Case Study in the Rise of Authoritarianism, for The Bulwark. Why would you spend all this time? What were you studying? What were you seeking to learn? We know the Republican Party capitulated to Trump. Why study it in one man in so much detail?
So I wanted to tell the story. I wanted to basically understand what the hell happened to this country during the Trump years. And I wasn't so interested in Trump himself because, you know, authoritarians come along in every country, people who we've had businessmen run for president, and a lot of them would have been dangerous. What happened this time was that a whole political party fell in line behind this guy. And the reason that I focused on one man to explain it was it's a complicated story, and I wanted to be able to trace over time exactly how the mindset of a senator, of a leading Republican, changed from diametrically opposing Donald Trump and understanding exactly why he was so dangerous to becoming his chief enabler. And because Lindsey Graham would not keep his mouth shut, because he talked so much, he wanted everyone to know what he thought all the time. There's this just amazing documentary trove of everything he said. So week to week, month to month, you can just see how his rationales, his ideas, his arguments change to accommodate Trumpism.
Explain, or what is your take on, there was a time when Lindsey Graham, not just because of his relationship to John McCain, although maybe that was it, fashioned himself as a kind of like truth teller in the party, particularly about, I remember interviewing him where he basically said, you know, if we become a party of just angry white people, and I think he might have said angry white males, like, we're just going to have no future. So he had some fights that he used to have with the part of his party that Donald Trump has now represents, or the people associate with Donald Trump. So how do you see that? Which is, it's not just his change with respect to a single person, but it's also change with respect to the way he used to think about his party, and maybe they're totally connected.
Yeah. So when Graham ran for president in 2015, he described himself as, he said Trump was trying to get all the people who thought Obama was from Kenya and was a Muslim and all that stuff. And Graham said, I'm going for the other crowd. So he was postulating that there was a lot of Republicans who didn't agree with that stuff, and that Graham was going to consolidate them, and that was going to be a viable base for a Republican candidacy. And what he learned was that the Trump base was much more of the party than he thought. And of course, Graham never got above 1% and he dropped out, right? And so Trump gets elected, and then you see how Graham changes to the point where in late 2017, by this point, Graham's been sucking up to Trump for a while. He's describing the Trump base as we decided that. And so he just made his peace with this base of the Republican Party. And John, you can argue that Graham had to do this because he was going to be, to get reelected in South Carolina, he needed the Trump base, and those are the people he would have to get to win a primary. But I think it's more than that. I think that he embraced Trump, he embraced Trump's people, and he just got inside that mentality of being one of those folks.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.